Good morning and welcome to the roundtable for this Wednesday. It's a delight to have you all with us. Very special program we have today. We are thrilled to welcome a special guest. I'll get to that in just a second. Our normal panel, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo will be with us beginning at 10 o'clock. In the meantime, let me first introduce WAMC's Alan Chartok. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning for the third time, Joe. I'm terrific, and I know you're doing great.
As are you, and I thank you very much. Let's let us talk to our wonderful, distinguished guest this morning. We are thrilled to have for this hour the former governor of Massachusetts, Deval Patrick. Last month, Patrick launched a political action committee, Together Fund PAC, to support presumptive nominee Joe Biden for president and Democrats running for the House and Senate in swing states and districts around the country. TogetherFundPAC.com for more information on that. And it is a great thrill to welcome the Berkshire's very own Governor Deval Patrick. Governor, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Joe, and good morning, Alan. Thank you very much for having me.
What a pleasure to have you on the program. Very nice to have you.
I apologize to your listeners for preempting your normally fabulous panel for this first hour. They are pretty great.
I want to go one step further and say how excited I am that we have this great man with us today. I thought he should
Thank
be the president. I thought he should be the presidential candidate. I wrote about it. I said it. But what the heck? Not everything I want is what happens. But I am so happy that you're with us today.
You know,
thank you so much for having me.
Let's just start off on that. You know, it wasn't really. It seems like it was 8 years ago, but it wasn't that long ago. At the beginning, just a few months ago in February, where you were actively running for president of the United States. What do you make of that now when you look back on it? And you know, are there any regrets? Anything of I mean, the immediate reaction was, oh, maybe it would have been different had he got in sooner. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, that was not just the reaction, but the narrative, and we could never overcome it. I mean, there is a value to having time, just as a practical matter. And I say this as someone who just loathes the idea of perpetual campaigns, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
But I think I was hearing and sensing so much unease in so many places about even this extraordinarily talented, but at that point narrowing field of candidates for president. And I was worried that and I say this as a Democrat who doesn't think you have to hate Republicans to be a good Democrat. We have come to expect the worst from the National Republican Party today. At the same time, I think we've come to expect the minimum from Democrats. And it's a time where it seems to me we need much more bold, much more transformational kinds of proposals, much of which we had, but also a willingness to engage with people who don't already agree with us and bring them in, because I think that's how you get, in my experience, lasting change. Even so, the narrative was something we couldn't overcome. I kept meeting people who said, oh, you're my candidate. I just wish you'd gotten in earlier, even though no one had yet voted. So that's a mistake I won't make again. Let me leave it at that.
That's amazing. We're lucky to have you in the Berkshires. Why are you here? What makes you live here?
Well, you know, there came a point. I mean, Alan, this is a story to some extent you already know, but your listeners may not. I was exposed to the Berkshires. I want to say almost 50 years ago when I did my orientation program for the A Better Chance program, which is what brought me from the South Side of Chicago to Milton Academy in the fall of 1970. We had 6 weeks at Williams College, which was, it was like nothing I'd ever seen. And in the years since, I've been exposed to the Berkshires through, professional friends and like the late Reg Lindsay, who was a colleague of mine in law practice and came to Hancock, or college friends like Yo-Yo Ma, who's been coming out this way forever. And it has everything that Diane and I love. It has the incredible landscape, extraordinary food, and the whole farm-to-table thing as a foodie means a lot to me. Incredible diversity of arts offerings, and it turns out, you know, remarkable people from all over the world. I have this kind of running giggle we have about how it feels some days like the Berkshires is full of a whole lot of people who were on their way home from what was the great music venue years ago, Woodstock.
Oh, yeah.
And then just decided, you know what, this is far enough. Let's just stay here.
And most people don't know that when you say you're a foodie, that you're a great cook. We were invited to your house twice, and I have to say, I know this is show-offy, but the first time we came to dinner at your house, there were 200 people there. And we said, well, you know, this isn't so much. So the next time we got invited, we say, well, the heck with him. We'll just go when we want to. We'll go later. And it turned out it was just us and another couple, you see. And,
we kept it warm. We kept it warm.
That's why they make hot plates.
Yeah, terrific. And I remember what you cooked. You cooked white fish. Oh. It was very, very good. Very good indeed.
Thank you.
Let's get back.
I just like to eat.
Yeah, well, we like to eat what you made. Let's get back to the... Let's get back to what's going on. You just talked about the Democrats and what we needed to do if you were a Democrat. And you made it clear, boldness. Do you think Joe Biden has, and I know you're collecting money for him, but do you think he has that boldness?
I think he is moving there really fast and really thoughtfully. You know, I can't remember who said it. It might have been Senator Warren in her endorsement that one of the great things about Joe Biden, someone I have known and worked with for decades, is that he, unlike a lot of people actually in public life, is willing to reconsider previous positions and to move. He's very thoughtful that way. He is deeply empathetic at a time when we are suffering from an empathy deficit. And I and others have been talking with his team about the importance of meeting this moment with proposals and a policy agenda and a sort of a scale and scope of leadership that will both, you know, repair our breaches.
You know, and
But not just sort of settle us down, but really give us hope that that meaningful change is on the way.
When you say this moment, I think a lot of people can take that many different ways just because everything seems so chaotic. So this moment, meaning Black Lives Matter and police brutality and police reforms, this moment, meaning that we're living through a pandemic where the latest numbers say that they're continuing to go up in this nation, and yet it seems to be virtually ignored by the administration. And in this moment, meaning the last 3.5 years of Donald Trump as president of the United States.
I mean, all of that and more. You remember the sort of rosy economic indicators we kept hearing about before the pandemic, and that so many commentators were worrying, who were observing that it would be so much harder for a Democrat to unseat Donald Trump in the midst of a booming economy. Well, those indicators never told the whole story, Joe. You know, unemployment is low as long as you count both or all three of the low wage jobs a whole lot of people have just to survive. You can't persuade anybody who is paying rent or a mortgage or a health care premium or a tuition bill that inflation is low because
right. They
don't see it from year to year in those payments. There are more than a few folks in the suburbs who are making ends meet using their credit cards and the local food pantry. And this was true before the pandemic. Mm-hmm. We've heard a lot about how students are trapped by either student debt or a criminal record, depending on whom they are. There are a whole host of ways in which prosperity and justice has not reached everyone everywhere. And in some respects, the pandemic exposed that. And then the killing of George Floyd by the Minneapolis police officers brought further attention not just to a culture or habit of excessive force, and I say that mindful that there are many, many police officers who show restraint and respect and have done so during these protests, but that there is a through line around devaluing the lives of Black and Brown people throughout our public policy. A lot of it we've just kind of gotten accustomed to over time. And so it is all of those things in this moment. This is what I've been saying for some while, long before I was a candidate, just, you know, reflecting over the dinner table with my family. If the character of the candidates is always an issue in an election cycle, this time it's the character of the country. And we should call that question.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess everybody wants me to ask the question about defunding the police. You know, the people who want to defund are saying defunding doesn't mean what it says. You know, it doesn't mean taking away all the money. What do you make of it? Joe Biden has spoken on it. Andrew Cuomo has spoken on it. What do you say?
Well, I think if defunding means actually not having police at all, I don't support it. It's a little frustrating. You know, it's such a great, catchy, sensational phrase. It's a little like abolishing ICE. I totally get it. But somebody's got to do that job. It just has to be done the right way. And I think we probably, most of us would want there to be policing, but it's got to be done the right way. I think what folks are getting at is a very, very important point when they talk about defunding the police. And it really is about refunding the social services, the community and human capacity building that we have been retreating from for a long time, right? It's mental health services. Mm. It's medical health services. It's assuring that the schools don't so consistently fail poor children. It's assuring that we're growing an economy out to the marginalized and the strivers and not just up to the well-connected, which we've been doing in fits and starts for 40 years. There are all kinds of ways in which we've been asking the police, and frankly, I would add to that, asking teachers to do what the whole community used to do, as expressed in many cases through our government. And that is a point I think is extremely well taken and that we need to address.
As an African-American male, just what do you make and what has the last 2 weeks been like for you to watch unfold?
I think I've had, my emotions have ranged from grief and sadness to anger and rage and frustration, and then back to grief and sadness. And I might cycle through that, you know, every few minutes.
Yeah.
There's a part of me that has so appreciated so many of my friends who are not Black, who have reached out and you know, expressed solidarity and asked what they can do. And there's a part of me that, for at least at the very beginning, though I appreciated those messages, I really didn't want to engage. Because I, like a lot of people, are feeling just so tired of what has become our habit of trying to put other people at ease before we can begin the conversation about systemic racism. And I say that as someone who's been incredibly blessed. I believe in the American dream because I have lived it. I have been given chances and have done my level best to make the most of them. But it's also true that, you know, the access to that dream, the things it takes to ready yourself and that create new opportunities, that's been constrained more and more. And frankly, I think that experience is being experienced by a whole lot of the country today who are not white as who are not black as well. We can come to that separately. But I feel like, you know, my wife sent me a comment that she had read or someone had sent her about who was responding to folks asking white people asking what they can do. And the response of this in this comment was, try letting your guard down and listening. Because there's some hard conversations, even with our friends and allies, that that need to be had, and the outpouring that we're hearing about how we think about policing, critical though that is, and the responses, much of them constructive, by the way, from law enforcement leadership. And rank and file police officers that we've read about or watched that are so promising right now that we might actually be able to engage around these issues. I would just without you know hastening past the question of the use of force, I would just ask us all to remember that the people who shot Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia were not police officers. Amy Cooper was not a police officer. You know, a person, this is the person in Central Park, as you may recall,
right.
Who, you know, what was revealed there is the larger truth, which is that she knew that by even pretending to be threatened by a black man, she could rain holy hell down on him. And by the way, you know it too, and so do I. And so just thinking about what impact that has on how your neighbor, your fellow citizen, raised to believe the same thing about American ideals, think about what that means in his or her daily life and what that demands or commands of all of us who think of ourselves as patriots about how we behave and what we in turn expect of our civic and political leaders.
Former Governor of Massachusetts Deval Patrick is our guest on the roundtable this morning till 10 o'clock. We do welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Governor Patrick and Alan Chartok. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. WAMC's Alan Chartok with me. We welcome our special guest for this hour, former Governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, Deval Patrick. Last month, he launched a political action committee, a Together Fund, to support presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden, and as well as Democrats running for the House and Senate in swing states and districts around the country. And it's a great pleasure to have him on our program.
Thank you very much. And I apologize. Your engineer was, or producer was telling me during the break that it's been a choppy connection. I'll try to speak up.
Okay, great. Thank
you. Sounds better now. I have the first question, if I may.
Absolutely.
Governor, and ask you this. How the hell did we end up with this particular president with all of the obvious character flaws? How did the American people vote him in, even if they didn't give him the most votes?
Well, there's so much to that question. I think it's largely rhetorical. Look, I think I would agree that we are cursed, Alan, with the worst possible leader for the times. because, you know, I mean, what President Trump has shown to me is that he is incapable of paying attention, of caring about and responding to any other needs but his own. And the notion that, and frankly, I had this hope that the gravity of the job would impress upon him that you are actually supposed to try to govern not just those who voted for you, not just those who agree with everything you you say, and indeed that the campaign ends and the governing begins. All those things I thought the gravity of the job, this being in the Oval Office would impress upon him, I was wrong. But I will say this. The one truth candidate Trump spoke in the run-up to 2016 was that a whole lot of conventional politics wasn't working for most people. And it's the same truth, by the way, that candidate Obama and departing President Obama talked about. It has been a truth for some while, which is my point earlier, that we cannot be about doing what we used to do. We have to think in fresh ways about how to meet the needs, not just of the mighty, but of the meek, wherever they are, and how to find their voices and let them speak to their needs, mindful that nobody I meet, despite the rhetoric of the hard right, is looking for government to solve every problem in their life. They're looking for government to help them help themselves.
Okay, Governor, I just want to say, is there something in the American psyche that our persona, that 38% of the people go for this? Well, what's the best word? Crap.
Maybe. But, you know, you may be asking the wrong guy, because I don't put a lot of stock in polls. And I think the sooner we all stop doing that, the better off we'll be. You know, I think there is an excusing of a whole lot of what Donald Trump has done, at least up to his mismanagement of the pandemic, because he was delivering on other substantive aspects of the hard right's agenda, right? The gutting the tax code so that it was so that it was and would be a giveaway to the very wealthy, even though there is hardly any data that shows that cutting taxes stimulates the economy. It's still a thing. They've been on it for a long time. They did that tax reform bill without any Democrats, including the Democrats who were trying to knock on the door and said, you know, I want to be a part of this. I want to influence how it goes. The stocking of the bench with hard right jurists, some of whom have been deemed unqualified by the American Bar Association, have never tried a case. That's an agenda that has been important to the hard right for a long time. So you know, the gutting of environmental regulations and so forth on the specious idea that somehow they interfere with economic growth, all that stuff. He says out loud some of the things they've been saying in code for a long time. It's indelicate. Mm-hmm. But he may have also served an important purpose. I think, you know, it turns out a whole lot of democracy depends on unwritten rules, right? Rules about decorum and restraint, about respect and duty. It's hard to write those into rules, but it turns out they're pretty important for democracy to succeed. And I think at least that lesson is clearer to more people who may have checked out than given up on politics than was the case before. At least I'm hopeful.
As I mentioned in your introduction, your PAC is working obviously on behalf of the Biden campaign in raising money, but also for Democrats running for the House and Senate. Do you think the Democrats can take the House? What are the chances?
You mean the Senate?
The Senate. My apologies.
Hold the House?
Yeah, hold the House and take the Senate, yes.
Yeah.
I think the chances are great. You know, we're focusing on, and I'll say it this way because everybody recognizes it this way, Joe, but I hate these terms. We're focusing on red to blue districts or states. And by that, I mean places where Democrats have not competed or haven't competed successfully in the past. And that really does come from my own confidence that if you engage with people and you run because you believe in something and you make it about a victory for the community, as a neighbor, for the state, and not as a victory for the party, which I think a whole lot of people are feeling a little tired of, you can compete and win. And I saw that working alongside Doug Jones in his special election in Alabama for the Senate. I was involved in 14 races, I think it was, in the midterms in 2018, all of them in districts or states of that kind on purpose, not places where there was a whole lot of media attention. It was about the candidates, and we had terrific candidates. And in 14 of those races, we won outright. In three, we lost by a hair. And in one, they had to do it over in North Carolina because the other side cheated so badly. We can win when we show up and compete and when we engage as neighbors, as fellow Americans, and when we tell the truth and stand for what we believe.
Markey or Kennedy?
I love them both. They're great. But I'm not going to endorse. it's a spirited race. I wish it were a more positive race. I know them both, and so I'm a little heartsick that it has taken the turn it has. But aren't we fortunate to have so much talent competing?
I've known you for a while, and I have such great respect for you, as I've said before. But I have to say,
thank you, Alan.
The thing that I love the most is your loyalty and your ability to keep your wonderful marriage to one of the most wonderful women I know, and, you know, going the way that you have, and you both have. You're great. She's a great lawyer. You have this commonality. What wisdom can you impart to the rest of us for how to do it?
Well, marry up. That's what I did. made a huge difference. I try to keep my perspective. I really do believe in this notion of servant leadership. It's might seem a little old fashioned, but if these jobs in public office are part substance and part performance art, I think probably one of my weaknesses is that I was slow to accept the performance art part of it. I worked real hard to get that in equipoise. And one of the things I worry the most about today is that we have kind of, just kind of given over to the performance art side, and there's a lot less substance. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, there's still room in civic and public life for someone who believes in servant leadership, that it's not about us. It's not about me. That is to say, it's not about the candidate or the office holder. It's about all of us. It's about how you lift everybody, how you make everyone feel that they have a voice and that they have been heard and seen. And I think if Diane were on this call, she'd take up all the time talking about my many, many faults. I know I am not finished. I know that. I'm impatient, and maybe I'm a little more maybe I suffer fools a little more than, you know, one ought to, if one is ambitious and trying to, make your move and all that, sort of thing. But in the long run, I've been blessed with a range of friends and perspectives and insights and kindness that people have shown me, and I'm just trying to pay that forward.
You have quite a crew there. You know, you mentioned Yo-Yo. You did not mention JT and Mrs. JT and Kim, and the people that you have assembled around you who are so extraordinary and who are counted as good friends. How did all of that happen? Did it just happen, or did somehow you have to work at that?
You know, it's so interesting. I was you mentioned JT and Kim. We were emailing just this morning. I got to know them. I got to know first Kim through the Moz, I think at Yo-Yo's birthday party. And for your listeners, don't get the impression this is how I usually hang. It's just, you know, these actually are real friends. And I was running for governor the first time. And I met Kim. James wasn't there. And we got talking, and she was saying, you know, James has just come off the Kerry campaign, and just I can't imagine that he would involve himself in another campaign because he was still grieving. And eventually, they came to an event we did in Lenox, and then he helped, and it was they helped. And it was incredibly generous, but past the politics, we just got to be friends. We vacationed together. They are extraordinary people, as you know. But, you know, right in their circle and in ours are other extraordinary people from this community who are not, you know, famed musicians. Or otherwise famous. They're just really extraordinary, solid people with both feet on the ground, trying to do what they can to leave things better for those who come behind us, which is exactly what I was taught is the reason we're here.
We have just a few more moments with former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick. His new political action committee is Together Fund. You can find out more by going to togetherfundpac.com. What do you make of what happened in Georgia last night? By all accounts, a complete mess. How do we get this right?
Yeah. You know, Joe, isn't it funny? We are, we have been, or once were viewed as the world's greatest experiment in democracy. And yet we go out of our way to make access to the fundamental of democracy as complicated and inconvenient as possible. And it feels to me that there was, again, from a distance, hardly any planning for the new set of realities we find ourselves in with coronavirus. And when you consider who was responsible for the planning at the state level and the new governor's history when he was Secretary of State and running for governor and before of involvement in vote suppression, it just seems to me every voter everywhere should be thinking right now about his or her plan to vote, exactly what they're going to do and when and where, if they are eligible for an absentee ballot, what is the deadline for getting it, how much time do you need to make sure you get it back, know where your polling place is going to be, may have a plan for being there and so forth. And then when we get the leadership we need in Georgia and elsewhere around the country, we need to go directly at these issues. When you step back, Joe, again, this will sound like this will come off as a partisan comment, but I'm just talking about the evidence. When you add up the voter suppression initiatives coordinated by Republicans across the country, the voter purging, this business of removing people from the voter rolls, registered voters because they haven't participated in elections in a cycle or two or three, making it harder to maintain your voter registration in this democracy than it is your driver's license. When you add to the variety of forms of poll taxes that have come back, you probably followed what was going on in Florida until a recent court decision with the ex-felons who had been given by popular referendum their right to vote back once serving their time. The gerrymandering and so on, it is more and more clear that at least at the national level, Republicans don't believe they could win a fair fight. And all I want as a citizen is a fair fight. Give everybody, let everybody make the case and give everybody who is eligible an opportunity to vote their conscience and their interests. If we had that, I think we'd see some profound changes, not just at the federal level, but right up and down the levels of government and leadership in our country.
But you do have one Republican friend, you've worked with him business-wise, who is distinguishing himself, and that's Mitt Romney. What do you think about the way that he has stood up to these bullies?
I really appreciate Senator Romney stepping up the way he has, and I've said so. In the same way, I appreciate the fact that he signed the bill I implemented to expand health care here in Massachusetts. And we got that to over 98% of our residents. I think we should be willing to call a good action, no matter who does it. And I guess my hope is that between his showing up the way he did and maybe Senator Murkowski's recent comments, that people are beginning to feel more balanced, or so-called moderate Republicans are beginning to feel like they have some cover to call the extraordinary cruelty of President Trump just what it is. And to move away.
So bring us into the political mind, if you could, and if you can. And this is about what happened yesterday. And I use it not because it's the story of greatest importance. However, it's a microcosm, and I think it's a good example. So the president writes a tweet yesterday morning about the 75-year-old in Buffalo, and saying that it could have been a setup, and he could have been Antifa, and blah blah blah. So reporters all over the country go to their senators and say, Republican senators, and say, what do you make of this? And there's deafening silence and no one speaks out about it at all. Why is that? And now you can extrapolate that to a million issues over the last 3.5 years. Why is that so hard?
You're asking the wrong person.
I know I know that, but I want never, you have a political mind.
I'm not sure even if what you want is a comment from a political mind that you're asking the right person. I never understand why it is people want to have these jobs but not do them. Why they don't come with an objective in mind about what they're trying to accomplish, and a set of convictions around which they're willing to lose an election. And if dignity and restraint isn't a part of it, then the future is bleak indeed. I mean, this we shouldn't have expectations of this president different than some of us do at this point, because he's had every opportunity to show us something else. The one thing he does either that is ingenious, either accidentally or on purpose, is that he is great at changing the subject. And he does the next outrageous thing, and we all go chasing that thing and wondering why it is his fellow Republicans don't call him on it. It could be, I don't know, but it could be that it turns out for many of them power is more important than principle. I feel certain that that is true with the majority leader in the Senate today, Senator McConnell. It may be true of others. I don't know. And by the way, like I said earlier, I don't think we get all we need as Americans simply by changing the majority in the Senate and holding the majority in the House and having a Democratic president, as hard as I will work to assure that's the case. We need the same urgency that folks on the streets in cities and towns all across America today are expressing from every American to assure that when we get leadership that is paying attention, they act.
We have often spoken, Governor, about circular firing squads the Democrats do. I'm interested in one thing. I wake up this morning and I see that Bernie Sanders and AOC have endorsed yet another candidate in the Democrats, while the Democratic moderate who is beating McConnell by 1 point. Do we sometimes just lose sight of what this is all about?
Well, look, I heard that this morning. I heard that this morning as well. And those endorsements are powerful endorsements. It doesn't bother me one bit that there's a competitive primary. Remember, I was in a competitive primary. Of course, sure. Nobody took me seriously when I ran for governor the first time. But it was a competitive primary. And I did get, when we did start to get momentum, I got blowback from folks saying, look, we haven't had a Democrat as governor in 16 years, and all of the establishment is organized around this candidate, who was then the sitting attorney general, and this isn't what we do. I'm not worried about. I wasn't worried about competition then. I'm not really worried about competition now. What I worry about is that once we have a nominee. Mm-hmm. After the primary in the Commonwealth of Kentucky, that we rally around that nominee and not go off in a huff to our respective corners within the Democratic Party if the nominee is not the person we backed in the run-up to the nominee. That's the thing to pay attention to.
When you look at where we are right now in a pandemic, and we haven't talked a lot about it this morning with you, and in our final moments, I guess, where do you think we are in this? And we're seeing reports this morning that cases are spiking around the country. I know your state, certainly New York, has tried to be very careful, but. And we really don't know, do we, what often the right thing is to do other than to trust science, which, again, doesn't seem to be trusted by those in national leadership.
Yeah, this is a challenge compounded in many ways, Joe, by the fact that we haven't had national leadership that would galvanize around a public health consensus about how to manage the virus, so that then states and localities could make judgments consistent with that. And you know, to the extent we did get federal guidelines, the president seemed to go out of his way to undermine them in his own behavior and what ultimately he encouraged other people to do. So that has been a problem, and that more than a problem. I think it has made the jobs of Governor Cuomo, Governor Baker, other governors and mayors much, much more difficult. I think what a strategy for a gradual reopening should be. At one point, there seemed to be some coordination, at least among governors in the region. I can't tell whether that stuck, but that was certainly the advice I was trying to give to people, because, you know, the pandemic could care less about where the state lines are. There is, as you know, an awful lot of movement between the western end of of Massachusetts and New York and Connecticut and Vermont, and the pandemic's not thinking about that kind of thing. I know out in the western part of the country, governors were trying to coordinate regionally. I don't know whether that has been sustained. It's just a really, really hard thing to manage through when the president himself has been undermining governors, at least governors who are governors of battleground states or blue states, so called, or not in his or not bowing to what his whim du jour was. So I don't know how to help here, other than to say that I commend Governor Cuomo, Governor Baker, Governor Lamont, who've done really, really good jobs of trying to convene their own public health experts and to take their guidance from that science. But a little more coordination among and between the states would probably be a good thing too.
Well, unfortunately, we have to wrap up. But what a pleasure to have you on the program. Right, Alan?
Thank you for having
yes.
me, Joe. Alan?
That's right. And you should be president.
Yeah, so work on that next time, will you?
Yeah, I keep that in mind. Thank you very much. But now, everybody should vote. We should have overwhelming turnout and participation. This is about who we are as Americans.
You can find out more information about Governor Deval Patrick's new PAC, TogetherFundPAC.com, TogetherFundPAC.com. Deval Patrick, thank you very much for being with us. A great honor to have you on the program.
Be well. Be well. Stay safe and healthy.
Thank you very much. All right, Alan, that was fun. When we come back, we'll take on Chris and Robert, Bob Griffin and Rosemary, and they'll join us for our panel. All that coming up right after news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Many thanks to Governor Deval Patrick for being with us for the first hour and for our wonderful panelists who were on the sidelines there for the first hour and join us now. Let me quickly introduce them. We'll get right to the conversation. Rosemary R. Mayo, investigative reporter and UAlbany adjunct professor. Good morning, Rosemary. How are you?
Good morning. Very well.
Also, we welcome Times Union columnist Chris Churchill. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Joe.
Nice to have you here. And Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin. Good morning, Bob.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Joe, I thought the governor was an awesome interview, although I wish he'd put somebody less capable in before us so we don't look as bad.
Oh, I think you can hold your own. So we talked to the governor about what happened in Georgia. By all accounts, an absolute mess, chaos. Alan, I didn't really get your thoughts on that, other than what you were talking about this morning. But let's talk about that and start off on, you know, it doesn't give you great confidence for what's coming over the next several months in voting in this country.
Look, it's so simple. We've seen it before. I've been talking about it. We've been talking about it forever. The Republicans know that if they can hold down the Democratic vote in certain districts, in certain places, even entirely because Republicans vote in greater numbers than Democrats who have to earn a living, that in fact it's a mess. So we know that this has always been this way. It took until the Democrats took the state Senate that the Republicans didn't have their way in terms of expanding the franchise there. So this is just as plain as could be.
Rosemary.
You know, I really would like to just think that it's Americans trying to get voting right, that the machines have been a problem you would not have thought to be as difficult to solve as this. But there are such signposts of corruption in Georgia, including the fact that the company that did these new machines that malfunctioned seemingly in black neighborhoods only, not in white. That is suspicious. That's one of the signposts. The other is that the company is owned by the former campaign manager of Governor Kemp, formerly Secretary of State Kemp, who worked really hard in that governor's race to tamp down Democratic voting and to purge voter rolls. So it really, really, I want it to be just an error. Something people are working on, but I don't really believe it. I think there's corruption and attempts to oppress the vote going on.
I mean,
and I don't see any way to fix this in Georgia or other places. It isn't just Georgia in November.
I mean, you don't want to create conspiracy theories, but look, there were great questions in that election that the governor ran against Stacey Abrams, and we seemed, Bob, only to see that extrapolated this time. Throughout the state for many other offices.
Yeah, Joe.
Exactly. I'm also impressed by the dedication of the voters in Georgia who stood in lines for 3 hours, who seemed to know what was going on, and they were fighting back. Not a good time to try to suppress the black vote right now when Black Lives Matter is on everyone's mind and injustice and inequality. It's recalling the civil rights movement.
Yeah, but the problem, Rosemary, is that if you can't win and they think that they can't win, then you cheat. And that's what they're doing. They're just cheating, and they think they have no choice.
Bob?
Yeah, Alan, I think there's a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B. I think drawing a connection back to Kemp's role in voter suppression in Georgia is absolutely justified. I also think that there are issues both at the state level and the Secretary of State and at the county level that needs to be looked at. And I certainly would urge anyone who's listening in New York who may be involved in the election and balloting process, you've been warned. And let's make sure that all of our systems, all the systems in all the states that we touch are reviewing their systems, are preparing, are upstaffing as far as ballot workers, because this is voting is essential to the continuation of our republic. I would only caution, I've said this several times, nothing looks like conspiracy quite like incompetence. And while I think there is certainly a maliciousness on behalf of Kemp when he was in Secretary of State, and I need to just tell everybody that I had personal run-ins with him as we were trying to talk about the 2016 election security, and he fought efforts at the time to make sure that the election systems were considered to be critical infrastructure, and I think that's carried on. I also think that there is enough blame to go around. Rosemary, you hit on a really interesting point that I think we got to come back to, though, is that it there does appear to be these systems worked differently in minority neighborhoods than it did in others. And frankly, this is where I think Department of Justice should be getting involved in looking at this.
Bill Barr is going to do it. He's going to be right there on the job.
Chris?
Yeah, I mean, whether it's incompetence or whether it's a conspiracy, either way, it's disgraceful. I mean, this is what our democracy is built on, is the right to vote, and people should be able to vote without having to wait in line for 3 or 4 hours. And Bob is right. This is a enormous warning sign to every state about November. I mean, we have to fix this. We can't go into the November election and have these kind of problems. I mean, Trump is just waiting to say that the election was rigged or that it was somehow, the Democrats are rigging it against him. And any sort of inconsistency or any sort of problem could really end up in just a disaster.
Especially when he's doing the rigging. I mean, that's what we're looking for here. And
that the election isn't close.
What are the implications at a time when mail voting, it makes a lot of sense from a health point of view, and Trump and his minions are saying, no, that's really corrupt and subject to problems.
Well, it's baloney. I mean, they know it's baloney.
It is?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm using a polite word there, but yeah.
And but, it's funny, Rosemary, it's good enough for Trump and his family to mail in votes, but it's not good enough for the rest of us.
Well, and Barr votes by mail, and Kellyanne Conway votes by mail. Everybody votes by mail in that administration. I mean, it's a ludicrous argument that they're making.
But meanwhile, TikTok, I mean, we have to get a system going here if we're going to have a chance at having some some form of a Democratic election come November.
Yeah, well, what's disturbing is that it just seems – it almost kind of falls off – well, it does, for some people, it seems to fall off the radar until Election Day. And then it's like, right. Oh, look, we have a problem again, you know, instead of kind of really focusing our attention. And, I mean, this country is a wealthy country. We can't get this right. It's unbelievable to me.
Hey, you all remember the Iowa caucus and what a screw-up that was?
Yeah, or the Texas vote where the students had to wait in line for 8 hours. I mean, this happens almost every time there's an election day.
We have Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo with us. We do welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be going to those shortly. Panel at WAMC.org. So what do we do about it?
Great question. Great question. I mean, you really don't. What do you have? You have an attorney general who is disgraceful and running the Justice Department. You have a president who is obviously encouraging all of this. The only thing you can do about it, and we've been saying this all along, is show up in massive, massive numbers and sweat it out in the hot sun and do whatever you have to do to take it back, because otherwise nobody's going to do it for you. That's for sure.
I think there are two things that you can do. One is what Alan just said. People have to march. This has become another movement. They have to stand up for their right and be inconvenienced by it. And those of us who are privileged need to be helping them by transportation or money to cover expenses if you're not working, whatever. We need to look into that. The second thing is that the Georgia Secretary of State has said, I will do an investigation.
Yeah.
That needs to happen. And investigations have to happen at other state levels, too. Remember, voting is conducted at states here, not at the federal level. So we know Barr isn't going to do anything. That means we put pressure on secretaries of state.
You believe it? You believe it, Rosemary? Well, that guy is good.
I'm very skeptical, but I think there has to be public pressure on him. He's made the pledge. Now he has to keep it. And that's on us to force that.
Bob?
I am in complete agreement, and you know, Alan, I think your incredulousness is well deserved. At the same time, I guess what I'm hoping is that we can start to establish areas that the next administration's attorney general and civil rights reviews will begin to look at, and I think this is one of those issues that needs to be near the top. But no, I don't have any faith that the Georgia officials are going to self-police themselves. And again, it gets back to the comment that was made several times earlier, and I thought very eloquently, is that this is why we actually have to be prepared to spend the 6 hours standing in line so we can vote some of these fools out of office.
You know, Mike makes a good point. He writes and says, since we're talking about voting, June 23rd is the New York primary. How do we vote? Do New Yorkers have the choice between mail-in or on-site voting? Do we know?
I got an invitation to send away for an absentee ballot, and I did it just to make sure I would have an alternative, but I haven't gotten anything. So I don't know the answer to that myself.
Yeah, I mean, me either. Chris?
And we've had mail.
I'm not positive, yeah.
We've had mail from people saying, I sent away, but I didn't get one, which makes it even worse.
I mean, we're getting, I know all the school votes around here are being done by mail at this point, but I'm not sure about the June election.
And they're also getting screwed up. I mean, right?
Yeah, well, there's issues about, some of them not being secret ballots and people being worried about that. There are issues with them for sure.
Well, the other thing that worries me is that I got an invitation to get an absentee ballot, but my mother, who's in the same district, the same address, voted as often as I do, she didn't get one. How's that work?
Well, that's because you're famous, Rosemary. They want to make sure you vote.
They want you showing up.
Thank you.
Watching what happened in Georgia yesterday, says Melinda, Republicans screw up at the polls in their response last week in Iowa. How do we fight that by November and make sure every person in every state can vote? So very disturbing. I think we touched on a lot of that, but yes, so very disturbing.
Well, one can still go to the courts, you know, and there's still some honest judges, although I'm not sure how long that'll last. But in the end, if you elect a Democratic president and a Democratic House and a Democratic Senate, if that happens, you're going to be seeing that they will be changing some of the norms, which we've always existed by, into laws, because Trump ignores norms.
Mm. Mm.
But that's a jump ahead. You have to elect that those senators.
Right, you are. Right, you are, Rosemary. And well, the other thing I was thinking is, you see all of these wonderful kids out there doing the protesting, right? There are a lot of young people. There's some older people too, but a lot of younger people. For those of us who have been in a classroom for a long, long time and have been disappointed when we really get to the nitty gritty of whether young people voted or not, it would be amazing to think that everybody out there in these crowds said, okay, I'm going to vote this time. And I have a feeling that could happen.
Yeah, I actually confessed on Facebook that I'm changing my mind on millennials and Gen Xers. They have to vote, no question about that. But what they've done in this last 2 weeks has been remarkable. We're seeing maybe a sea change in thinking about black rights and our justice system. To talk about defunding police, it's unbelievable. It's equal to me to the change that we saw in thinking on same-sex marriage. And that is to their credit and to their activism, and I salute them.
Yeah, I don't know. Right, Rosemary, I think you're catering to my son and his friends. Are you sure about that?
Yeah, it hurts me because, my granddaughter, if I do something she doesn't like, goes, oh, you're such a boomer. Guess who taught her that? Her father, Jen Esther. So, yeah, it's a personal battle in my family, but you cannot ignore what has happened. It's this extraordinary outpouring and effectiveness. We've already seen changes in local and state laws. That's amazing. And as someone who demonstrated and marched and did all of the protesting against Vietnam, I thought our generation did it right, but I tip my hat. It's great, and it has to continue.
Chris, you had questions?
No, I was just going to say, I was just going to back up what Rosemary is saying. I mean, the way that we've seen laws change and stances crumble in the last 2 weeks, it's like nothing I've ever seen. You know, I mean, 50A was just one of those things that was just, which is the law that, shields police personnel records in New York, was just one of those things that was just always an impediment to getting to the truth, and it's disappearing. Yeah. It's unbelievable. It's
already amazing.
Yeah, and it's only been 2 weeks. I mean, and it is. You guys are right that it's a lot of young people.
We're going back and forth. Go ahead, Chris. Go ahead.
I was going to say you're right that it's a lot of young people who are out there marching, but if you look at the opinion polls, It's amazing to me that there isn't more of a backlash to all this, and that it's amazing to me how much of the public is supportive of this. Part of me just can't really get my finger on what exactly is happening and why this case was kind of the one that broke the dam. But it is extraordinary for sure.
That's an interesting point. Do you think there will be? Do you think it's just delayed, the backlash, or do you think we've gone past it?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. I mean, the people, the usual, with the exception of the president, the usual people who are, it's just been a lot of quiet from the opposite side, from the law and order side. And maybe it's just that they finally see that the morality of their argument is just, there's nothing to stand on there. I'm not really sure. I mean, there will be some sort of a backlash, and there is a small one. You know, if you see my email inbox, you can see the people who are pretty angry about all this, but it just seems to be a pretty small segment of the population so far.
I think that the Republicans and police officers and police unions, who would be the vanguard of that backlash, have no idea how to respond to the outpouring of public opinion at this point. And those who have look so small. Did you see the letter that the mayor of Albany got from the head of the union when she said, yeah, we're not going to have chokeholds in Albany. Forget it. That's gone. Yeah. And he wrote that this was an insult to policemen because it implied that they used them in Albany when they didn't. That yeah. is so, it just sounds so small, doesn't it? And you they cannot react right now because it just looks small and meaningless in light of what's happening on the street.
I mean, the cynical part of me wants to point out that the politicians who are enacting all these laws and all these changes could have done all this years ago, right? I mean, it's a lot of the same people who've been in office for a long time. But the difference is that the police union, the power of the police unions prevented them, the political power of those unions prevented them from taking these steps. And I think the unions right now have just been overwhelmed by what's happening on the streets. You know, I mean, the pressure is from the other side now, and politicians are really responding to it.
So the real question is, what are those Republicans?
All of our discussion, Alan, about what good did protests do? We're seeing that. This is in the last 2 weeks.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, there's a real question whether this goes just gets sustained, because sustenance is a huge part of what we're watching here. If it's just a hurricane coming through, and then once it goes through, or if there's some words you can't use on the radio. Let's put it this way. If the people who were really supporting this whole idea of, you know, curbing the police, if they screw it up and make demands that can't be met, you know, I got a letter the other day calling me, I'm sorry to say it, a racist, because I said, well, look, you know, this business about defunding is if we have to have a police force. The governor says it. Joe Biden says it. I'm saying it. And, you know, there are people who are going to go too far. And when that happens, they're going to ruin it for everybody. I mentioned that the governor, Patrick, but, you know, this business about Bernie Sanders, they've got Mitch McConnell on the ropes down there. His opponent is leading by 1 point. Well, still, the chances are that she won't win, but she's leading by 1 point. And now Sanders and group and AOC bring in another person to run in the primary and screw it up. It's unbelievable to me.
Yeah, I mean, you make a good point about the sustainability of it all. And I do agree with you about defund the police. I mean, most people who say it don't mean it literally. They're talking about trying to curb out of control budgets and take some of that money and put it toward preventative stuff rather than law enforcement, which makes perfect sense. I mean, you know, police are asked to deal with all these problems from addiction to homelessness to, you know, traffic control that really are kind of a little bit outside what they should be focusing on. But I do agree that, you know, there is that phrase resonate or scares people. And I do think that could generate a backlash if people aren't careful about explaining exactly what they mean.
That's right.
Yeah, Chris, I think you're onto something there. I'm sorry, Alan, go ahead.
No, you go, please.
I think, you know, you're onto a really important point, and I do also worry about the words that are being used. I mean, we're not talking about creating unsafe communities. We're actually talking about shifting to make sure that the community needs are being met. And if you think about over time, because we have so weakened a lot of our social supports and mental health supports, so all these responsibilities have fallen to law enforcement or the 911 centers. And if we could start to put some resources back into dealing with sort of the core issues, or frankly surround law enforcement with the capacity to deal with the mental health and addiction issues, we're actually making our communities safer.
We have Chris, I'm going to hold you there. We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have letters and many more topics to discuss. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary R. Mayo. We will continue our conversation. And again, we welcome your letters. panel@wamc.org. Keep them short. Keep them to the point. And we'll get to as many as we can on the other side of the break right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, and Rosemary R. Mayo on the panel this morning. Bob Griffin got called away. He has to go do his job. Okay. What? Whatever.
What's wrong with that guy?
So he had to leave us during the break. He was very upset about it, but we told him not to worry about it. We'd still welcome him back next week. But
well, we don't have enough people to talk. That's the
right.
Problem.
I know. We have limited time and a lot to talk about.
Does that mean there's some sort of Homeland Security thing going on that we should know about?
You know,
why was he called away exactly?
I did want to ask that, Chris. I must admit, I did want to ask that. But hopefully we're okay. All right.
By the way, one letter that we got, I think that we should read from Eric, who said, the primary is June 23rd. I received my mail and ballot in Albany. I've already filled it out and mailed it. No problems. Well, you know, there's an old Yiddish expression. There's an old Yiddish expression that goes, I can't do it in the original Yiddish, but it goes, for example, stinks.
I like it. Even that version of Yiddish.
Don't you see?
Yeah. We got a lot of these that said, like Jen said, I got my absentee ballot to vote in the primary a few days ago. So hopefully they're making their way to everyone that has made the request. Also... But yeah, go ahead, Chris.
That raises the point that you have to request them, right? Because that's what we weren't entirely sure about. You have to request them. I think that's I'm a little embarrassed not to know, but I'm pretty sure that you have to.
This one for Rosemary. I already received mine in the mail and voted proudly for Bernie Sanders. Glad I got the chance to do it for the last time. Also, Mary said absentee voters who can't get ballots in six-hour wait times at the polls assure that elderly voters have an even harder time making their voices heard than the rest of us. Marie said, yes, you can vote in the mail in the New York State primary. My husband and I have already done so. If you sent in an absentee ballot application and have not received a ballot, call your county board of elections and find out why. But this goes back to...
Yeah, calling is a great idea if you've got like 3 or 4 hours to sit in the phone.
Well, and this gets into the problem, right, about making it so hard to vote.
Yeah.
Well, right, one problem obviously is that there is a pandemic on, you know, and election workers haven't been that easy to find during this time. Nevertheless, when it's happening in Georgia and in so many of these Republican states where voter suppression is so historic, there's no question what's going on in my mind.
Right. You know, I do. Let's see. We have about 10 or 12 minutes left. I would like to go to the other big issue. Of course, we talked about it a little bit with Governor Patrick, and we talked about it yesterday. But virus cases are surging, coronavirus cases. And the question is, the New York Times article with the headline, "The World Reopens Despite Skyrocketing Coronavirus Cases." And it really is striking. The article reads, 2 months ago, when there were roughly 1 million confirmed coronavirus cases and the primal politics of survival was sweeping the world, shutting down was the order of the day. This week, the number of cases soared past 7 million, with 136,000 new infections detected on Sunday alone, the highest single-day total since the pandemic began. And the order of the day? Reopening. Terrified after watching economies built over the course of decades hollow out in a matter of weeks, countries seem to be saying, in effect, enough. That seems concerning, doesn't it, Rosemary?
Again, you're not going to get governments, especially our government, who's going to look out for you. They have made your choice about what you do in the pandemic a matter of gender and a party, and somehow anti-Trump to wear a mask, for example. That's ridiculous and divisive, but we already know that. And I think it's going to come down to personal choices. We're seeing here in New York that Memorial Day seems to have coincided with the increases in some places of the disease. So if you went out on Memorial Day to celebrate summer as if nothing were different, you're paying a price for it now. And I don't wish it on anybody. Well, I do on one person, but I won't bring that up again. But I don't wish it on people. You have to be aware that that's a price. There's a price for bringing back the economy. I don't think the world, and I definitely don't think America is ready to reopen the economy fully again.
The only thing that Trump can hope for is a reopened economy. We know that. Not only that, but he's going to put thousands of people sitting right next to each other in, one of his rallies, because he considers that to be his political success, and what he's doing. It has nothing to do with protecting people's health. I mean, I saw this morning that all kinds of movie theaters are opening up. Are you kidding?
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I would add is that conditions vary so much. It's kind of a local place-by-place situation. I mean, my only problem with that New York Times article is that it frames the numbers in kind of a global, way.
Right.
When really there are areas where it's exploding and areas where it's almost non-existent. And I do think there are places where it is safe to open the economy, and then there are other places where it is absolutely not safe to do so.
Chris, I understand that, and I agree with you, but we do know that this virus travels, and it seems that if we and Governor Cuomo, I think, has been very articulate in this, that if we don't keep our guard up here, it could return, and the same for these places where the numbers are low.
Right. I mean, that's absolutely true, and that's why, public health officials have to keep their eyes on the numbers, and if they start to see an uptick, they'll have to take measures. I mean, I do worry a little bit that some public health officials in the United States, at least, have lost a little bit of credibility, and that the public just kind of doesn't believe them anymore and may not be willing to respond when they do sound the alarm next time. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, it travels. I mean, if it's exploding in South America right now, it'll come back here eventually. It's just we have to be ready for it when it does.
And our track record isn't great on that, right? I mean,
yeah.
We're getting misinformation and confusing information too. Trump, of course, is and his administration is obvious, but who did us no favors with that whole dust up this week about whether you can catch the COVID-19 from asymptomatic people? I am utterly confused, and I've read several articles. What are they doing? It's part of public health, and New Albany has a great school of public health, and part of what they have to do is send out clear messaging. We're not getting that.
No.
Well, the problem is they don't know. The problem is that this virus has properties which we still don't understand. You say, well, they got to be more clear about it. Yeah, if they knew what they were doing.
There's also this study that I think it came out yesterday that suggested that the virus has been around a lot longer than we thought.
Right.
That it was around last summer, at least in China, and which also changes a lot of things.
I believe it. Both Rosemary, I've mentioned it before. Both Rosemary and I had terrible coughs on the panel. I mean, terrible. They wouldn't go away. They lasted for weeks. I'm still of the opinion that may have been, and I really have to get myself tested, not for the COVID itself, but for the antibodies. I think that may have been what we're talking about right now.
Well, and I've wondered if I had it too. And I was sitting in a small room with you.
Yes, you were.
If you did, I probably did.
I guess
too.
We're all screwed.
You know what? We knew it.
Yeah.
So we heard from Dr. Fauci yesterday, the top infectious disease expert who delivered the grim assessment, describing COVID-19 as his worst nightmare and a warning that, quote, in a period of 4 months, it has devastated the whole world and it isn't over yet. Of the 136 new cases reported on Sunday, 3/4 of them were in just 10 countries, most in the Americas, South and South Asia. They also include India, Brazil, Mexico, and South Africa. So concerning news, but nice to hear from Dr. Fauci finally again.
You know what's really great?
What?
Coffee.
Ice cream,
coffee. Why, are you enjoying the Java this morning, Alan? Are you?
I'm enjoying it, boy. I'll tell you, it's really great.
Good. excellent. Let's go to a couple of letters that we have. We got this from Jesse, who says, when I first heard about the McConnell race endorsement by Bernie AOC, I was alarmed, but could it potentially be even more beneficial to McGrath? She can now truly be the moderate and separate from the radical left. Getting Mitch out would be massive.
It's a good letter. I thought of it. But I tell you, you get that dissonance, and now you get people who say they're really ticked off. I don't like to use the P word, but they're really ticked off because they believe that their person, who was the more liberal person, didn't win. This is another case of Bernie and AOC, I think, not keeping their eye on the ball right now, which is to take the Senate back. And there could be no greater message than defeating Mitch McConnell in terms of the party. Look, those Republican senators have a really rough road right now. Mm-hmm. They can't, when the president says something really stupid, and tweets something else out, they go home to their wives or their husbands, I'm sure, and say, "What an idiot! What is he doing? He's killing us!" But the Manu Raju walks up to them in the my hero, by the way, Manu Raju. I like to say his name a lot, and walks up to them in the thing, and they say, "I can't talk to you about this. I just can't talk to you about this." Well, they're in a rock and a hard place.
And I know you guys talked about it yesterday, but let me just say that tweet yesterday was one of the more despicable moments of the Trump presidency. I mean, that was really I like to think I won't be shocked anymore. And then that one really kind of I couldn't believe it.
Well, it's flat out bonkers, right? I mean, that was
it's bonkers, but it's also cruel, right?
Absolutely.
You know, you're talking about a guy who's in the hospital. You're smearing him with, you know, a conspiracy without any facts whatsoever. And for what purpose? I mean, not that there's ever a good reason to smear somebody, but it didn't serve any purpose whatsoever. It just came out of the blue, and it was just confounding to me, just completely confounding.
I am going to...
I need to walk back something I said yesterday in response to a letter about suggesting that perhaps if more women were in the police forces and in leadership, there would be a difference to what we're seeing now on the streets. And my sons, this is the curse of a feminist raising sons, they push back, pointed out that case in Texas where the woman officer walked into an apartment not her own and killed the rightful resident as he slept or as he just woke up. So this is a matter, I think brutality is a matter of culture rather than gender or of geography. And I think that's a good point. I want to bring that up.
I want to end on a note that is a cultural one. I'm interested in what the panel thinks of it. So HBO Max is a streaming service they just started late last month and putting all kinds of just like crazy amounts of content up there for a price tag of $15 a month. One of the movies that was added to their library of films was Gone with the Wind. Now, HBO Max has said they're going to pull Gone with the Wind from the library. You cannot watch it on their service anymore, at least temporarily. The removal of the film comes as mass protests sweep across the U.S. following the death of George Floyd, an unarmed black man who was killed while in police custody. The movie has always been controversial. Its portrayal of slavery, African Americans, and the Civil War South have been received much more critically in the decades since its release in 1939. But it is considered to be a cinematic classic and one of the most popular films ever made. Should it stay? Should
Mom
it go?
Mom and I just reading the book, and the language, blacks talking in dialect, the terrorization of the KKK as if it were a good thing. There are horrible things in it, but it's like Mark Twain. It's first of all, it's a cultural thing, and second, in that book are the roots of the same white privilege and hatred of between the races that we have now. It actually was pretty illuminating.
Chris?
And then there's Clark Gable.
Yeah, I mean, I have mixed feelings about it. I mean, it is part of our history, and to kind of erase it, I think sometimes is dangerous. You know,
Are we still playing Birth of the Nation?
Yeah, I mean that was going to raise. I couldn't remember the name of the movie, so I didn't raise the point. But I was thinking about that. I mean, yeah, Well, some people do watch it, right? But it's that movie net doesn't have the kind of cultural popularity that Gone with the Wind does.
That's true, but it's history. It's who you are and who you're. Yeah.
The service is saying that they want to be able to, they want to put it back, but they want to wrap it in a cultural context, which...
Yeah, that's good.
Is it?
I mean, we read it, and you read the stuff about Reconstruction and the way the Yankees drove and punished Southerners with trying to put blacks in charge of them when they were still disenfranchised. And you can see where the hatred is growing, and it was like all of the authors and writers telling us now, look back at our racial history and to understand what's happening now. It's in that book, but you have to have the context that, you know, we don't think this way now.
You know, and that racial history is very important for people to remember, and that it gets forgotten. I continually get letters from people who say, you know, slavery ended, you know, almost 200 years ago or 150 years ago. Mm. Why are you saying that racism is still a problem? And people just don't understand, I think, what came after the end of slavery sometimes, or they just willfully forget it, perhaps. But,
the death of Lincoln was truly a tragedy because he would have changed the whole tenor of construction.
I bet.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we are out of time. My thanks to everybody. Thank you. Alan, thank you very much.
Joe, thank you very much.
Thanks to Chris Churchill and to Bob Griffin, who had to leave us early, and Rosemary Armeo. We will return with the Congressional Corner with Alan and Joe Kennedy right after this.